Hello, I'm John Dennis. It's Thursday the 30th of April. Today, with the first death outside Mexico, swine flu moves closer to becoming a pandemic.
This was originally a swine influenza virus, a new swine influenza virus, but it is now behaving more or less like a human influenza virus, with transmission going from person to person.
Also today, MPs vote on reforms to their expenses. Another test of Gordon Brown's authority.
All the MPs are carrying around big plastic bags full of expenses. They've got to vet them all, sign off on them all, and then they're going to be published. I mean, it's costing a lot of money, but we're in this mess because the public has lost confidence in the system.
And a year after he ousted Ken Livingstone, we consider the record of London Mayor Boris Johnson.
He hasn't been too bad for a Tory.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But now Bill Overton's got the news.
The World Health Organization says the world's on the verge of a swine flu pandemic. It's raised its alert system after a Mexican child died of the disease in Texas, across the border in the US. The WHO is also now sure the virus is passing from person to person and not just from animals. Officials in Spain have confirmed the first case of the flu in someone who's not been in Mexico, where the outbreak began. The Director General of the WHO is Dr. Margaret Chan.
Influenza pandemics must be taken seriously precisely because of their capacity to spread rapidly to every country in the world. On the positive side, the world is better prepared for an influenza pandemic than at any time in history. All countries should immediately now activate their pandemic preparedness plans. Countries should remain on high alert for unusual outbreaks of influenza-like illness and severe pneumonia. At this stage, effective and essential measures include heightened surveillance, early detection and treatment of cases, and infection control in all health facilities.
Dr. Margaret Chan of the World Health Organization. There have been confirmed cases of swine flu in 9 different countries. European health ministers are meeting in Luxembourg to coordinate their controls to prevent a spread from the 4 countries where it's already been found in the Union. The health commissioners talk to the drugs companies to speed up the production of antiviral drugs. The vaccines may take months to develop. A government advertising campaign with advice on keeping swine flu at bay launches in Britain today. Citibank has received £5 billion in bonuses this year, even though the government's pumping billions into the banks to keep them going. The figures come from the Office of National Statistics. The TUC says it's not what taxpayers would expect. The Liberal Democrat spokesman Vince Cables described it as alarming and says it shows a complete lack of awareness in the city. The CBI's responded, saying that bonuses given for hard work and success are not a problem. The House of Commons Public Accounts Committee has complained that a government company set up to help world poverty was paying its chief executive nearly £1 million a year. The company, CDC, is owned by the Department for International Development and helps business in the developing world. The report says the company had increased the pay of its boss, Richard Lang, to £970,000 last year. The committee was also concerned half the company's capital was not invested abroad at all, but in Britain. The consumer organisation Which? Has found DIY Botox kits for sale on eBay, the internet auction site. Botox is a poison and buyers were simply given a map of the body showing where it should be injected. eBay's now removed the offer. Football in the second Champions League semi-final, an all-English affair. Manchester United beat Arsenal 1-0 at home. It was a goal by John O'Shea that broke through the Arsenal defence. After that, goalkeeper Almunia managed to keep out all further attempts from Man U's array of strikers, Rooney, Tevez and Ronaldo. Most of the papers expect Manchester to win eventually after the second leg, but as the Times puts it, United missed chance to kill off Arsenal as Almunia stands firm. The Express says United was fired by O'Shea rocket and the Sun offers us hip hip O'Shea. The front pages mostly have something about swine flu. The Guardian has the raising of the pandemic alert with a WHO report. The Sun tells us there are 5 Brit victims and that the outbreak just got worse. The Independent reports there's a crucial flu drug for 50 million Britons. as ministers increase the stockpiles to cover three quarters of the UK population. The other main story is the Commons vote on the right of Gurkha soldiers to stay in Britain after retiring from the army. Gurkha's march to victory as Brown beats a retreat, writes The Telegraph, over a picture of actress Joanna Lumley hugging one of her soldier friends. The Express has her holding up a cookery knife in front of her fellow campaigners, beside the headline, Brown's bid to ban Gurkhas thrown out by angry MPs. The Mail sums up the long-running dispute, now let them stay. There's more news and sport throughout the day on Guardian.co.uk.
The World Health Organization has said it's closer to declaring that the swine flu outbreak has become a pandemic. Germany and Austria are the latest European nations hit by the disease, and in the United States, in Texas, a boy just 23 months old has become the first to die from swine flu outside Mexico. The Guardian's Chris McGreal is in Washington.
They've now confirmed human-to-human transmission not only across the border from Mexico in the United States, but also it looks like in Europe with the first case in Spain. That, from the WHO's perspective, takes us an important step closer to a worldwide pandemic and would require additional responses. They haven't put a time frame on when that might be, but sometime in the near future, the emergency committee will meet and make a decision.
The death of the little boy in Texas is a significant moment in the spread of the virus.
It is. It's significant in that whilst the child was from Mexico and had come across the border with his family to visit people in Houston or in Brownsville, I gather, right on the border, the child had been taken to hospital and had been treated fairly aggressively for the disease and still died. That has some health officials worried because it suggests that the child did not respond to the treatments that are available. They're not particularly worried about the nature of the infection because that appears to have taken place in Mexico and other family members don't appear to have been infected. But the fact that the child didn't respond to the treatment in a Houston hospital is somewhat worrying. And the governor of Texas has now gone so far as to declare the state a disaster area because of confirmed infections both in Texas but also because, of course, what's happening immediately across the border in Mexico.
Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger has declared a state of emergency in California. I mean, how are the authorities in the US responding to this?
Well, the state governors tend to respond to this in this way because it allows them to release up emergency funds for distribution to deal with this problem. So whilst the declarations sound very dramatic, in fact, it's also the kind of thing they do when there's an environmental or weather disaster of some kind. But nonetheless, the US authorities do seem to be quietly very concerned about what's going on. The US Health Secretary today announced that they've begun to distribute antiviral drugs across the country, about 12 million doses. And they've also begun work on a vaccine. Now, that vaccine won't be ready for months, but there's a real concern now that whilst this virus doesn't seem to be spreading particularly fast within the US, cases popping up here and there all the time, but not overwhelming the population. It could go dormant for the summer and then come back with a vengeance with the onset of the flu season next winter. And so they want to get the vaccine underway and distributed ready for the next flu season.
Chris McGreal. Well, over the border in Mexico, more than 150 people are now thought to have died in the outbreak of swine flu. Many of the cases are clustered around the village of La Gloria. Authorities are investigating the possibility that the swine flu outbreak originated from waste from a local farm, Grandias Carol. A spokesman for the facility told The Guardian that the farm was not to blame.
I was in farms both Monday and today. In fact, the same farm that is drawing a lot of attention because it happens to be the closest to this community. Yeah, I mean, you see what I do, but my undergraduate education is agribusiness. I'm very familiar with these animals. I've worked with this for a long time. They show zero signs of having any illness whatsoever. They're extremely healthy. We have a regular program to maintain that and to react to things if it's not that way. And I'm sure you talk to a lot of people and you kind of, they're going to give me what they would want me to hear. But I even today made a point of, because I was getting a similar reaction, you know, and someone covering their mouth and all, made a point of getting, I'm not concerned with this in the least, you know, right in with the pigs and my face next to theirs. And it's an obviously healthy herd. And even beyond that, I'll tell you, having just finished our international business meeting, the mortality levels in this business are at record lows. They're doing extremely well in their production, not just with volume, but also with the quality of what they're producing, the weight it reaches, the health of the animals. This business is being run very well, very successfully.
In Britain, the government is preparing to send a leaflet on swine flu to every household. During Prime Minister's questions in the Commons yesterday, Gordon Brown confirmed 3 more cases in Britain, bringing the UK total to 5. One of them is a 12-year-old girl whose school in Torbay in Devon has been closed.
I believe that we are taking the preparations that are necessary and the precautions to prevent the incidence of this disease in this country. I can confirm that we have enhanced airport checks. I also confirm that we're advising people not to travel to Mexico unless necessary. We will continue to review that position. At the same time, we've decided to build up stocks of antivirals from 35 million to 50 million. We are ordering a great deal more face masks, and we will be sending out public information to all citizens in this country. And by Tuesday of next week, there will be an information leaflet available for every family. The World Health Organization has said that we are one of the best prepared countries. We intend to keep it that way, and we intend to make sure that we do everything in our power to make sure that people are safe from this worldwide flu.
Now, some commentators, including The Guardian's esteemed columnist Simon Jenkins, have poured cold water on what's been seen as media hysteria over swine flu. Ben Goldacre's column Bad Science is a fixture of Saturday's Guardian, and Ben's been invited to join the swine flu sceptics, but he's declined to do so. He's even put out a challenge via Twitter to send him any misleading or scaremongering news stories. So, apocalypse, Hammageddon, or have the media been misrepresenting the facts over swine flu?
I don't think they have been. I mean, to be honest, I've been quite weirded out by, firstly, a huge number of people emailing and Twittering me, assuming that this is a health scare. And in my mind, that kind of just demonstrates the extent to which the media has absolutely no credibility anymore on issues of medicine and science. But the other thing that's been weird is lots and lots and lots of people from mainstream media have been asking me the same thing. So, you know, I had the guy from, I mean, nothing dramatic, but, sort of, you know, the guy from BBC Wales was saying, oh, will you come on our breakfast show and talk about how it's all a scare story? And I said, well, you know, it's not all a scare story, and I know you have this sort of slavish thing about on the one hand and on the other. And he said, well, what about, because, you know, maybe it could be a scare story like SARS and bird flu. And I got the same thing off, I mean, Simon Jenkins effectively says the same thing in The Guardian. And it's weird. It demonstrates to me an inability to kind of think around the notion of risk. It shows our inability to cope with uncertainty, because SARS and bird flu were risks. The fact that they were risks that weren't realised doesn't change the fact that they were risks.
I mean, Simon Jenkins in his column says that the risk of catching swine flu must be millions to one. I mean, isn't that true?
The thing about infectious diseases epidemiology is it's very, very difficult to make good predictions. The error margins on the predictions that you make with infectious disease epidemiology are incredibly wide. So when people say up to 120 million people, they mean what they say, you know. And I've been hoping that somebody will give me an example of a newspaper getting stuff wrong. Sure, they've used sort of slightly histrionic pantomime and theatre in the language and the headlines, but it is true to say that up to 120 million will die. And of course, I mean, it's not the example that he uses, but the example I use, I suppose, is Chagas disease. You know, of course there are other things that are killers in the world that aren't getting as much attention right now, but this is new and, you know, it could kick off. People, pandemics happen, and they are frightening. 20 million people died in the Spanish flu epidemic after World War One, and that's 3 times as many as died in World War One. I mean, it makes a mockery, really, of morality, really. You know, it's a huge biblical meaningless death, and it does happen, and it's weird to me that people kind of want to say that it won't.
And yet, you know, Simon Jenkins scorns the travel advice coming from the EU and the British government not to travel to Mexico unless it's urgent, because he says it would make more sense to warn against the American crime rate. I mean, hasn't he got a point there?
Well, with all risks, there's a question of how do we put this in context. And I suppose you could say there are risks that people already know about, and so they've already made decisions about, and perhaps they've made irrational judgments about the risks that they're willing to tolerate. So, you know, I'm happy to drive a car occasionally, although I know that for a bloke my age, it's probably the most common cause of death is, you know, car crash and violence. And yet, you know, I'll wander around central London a bit drunk and I'll drive a car. So I'm already exposing myself, it's true to say, to the biggest risks that I'm exposed to. But you know, I'm still interested in risk information on new stuff. I'm still interested in the notion that there might be a pandemic flu, even if it doesn't kill me and even if it doesn't kill people in my country. I mean, it's still an interesting story. I'm not sure that it has to be about whether I myself will die.
Ben Goldacre. And there's full coverage at guardian.co.uk/swineflu. And as for Twitter, you can follow this very podcast there at twitter.com/guardiandaily. Also on The Guardian's website today, Sri Lankan novelist Ramesh Gunasekara on the troubles of his homeland at guardian.co.uk/Sri Lanka. Stephen Fry's letter to himself, written 25 years ago, is at guardian.co.uk/G2. And there's an interview with David Mackay. He's the Cambridge physics professor who's gained many fans for the theories outlined in his book Sustainable Energy, which was given away free online. Read about him at guardian.co.uk/environment. The Commons votes today on changes to the system of MPs' expenses. The motion calls for claims on London MPs' second homes to be scrapped, for MPs to submit receipts for their expenses claims, and for MPs' staff to be employed by the Commons and not by the members themselves, and for MPs to declare all outside earnings. The Prime Minister had hoped to outflank his political opponents by suddenly announcing last week that there'd be a vote on his proposed reforms of MPs' second home allowances. But instead, today's vote is being seen as a test of Gordon Brown's authority. How did that happen? Commentator Michael White is in our Westminster office.
Well, he thought he'd clear up a mess ahead of the promised publication of the MP's expense allowance. Millions of expense claims over several years, which was, if you remember, the result of a Freedom of Information application. That's due in July. All the MPs are carrying around big plastic bags full of expenses. They've got to vet them all, sign off on them all, and then they're going to be published. I mean, it's costing a lot of money, but we're in this mess because the public has lost confidence in the system. Mr. Brown could see this enormous train crash coming down the road, and he thought, well, let's sort out the problems which this is going to highlight before it actually happens, so we can say, look, we've done it, we've addressed it, let's get on with more important matters.
It's more the way that he tried to sort this out, though, isn't it, that's caused him problems?
Well, two things there. Mr. Brown's officials have been telling reporters the last couple of days, well, you know, 90% of what the Prime Minister proposed will be sorted out. The one exception is the additional costs allowance, the ACA as it's known, which is what provides MPs with the money for their mortgages, or in some cases rents, but these days mortgages. And of course, that's the biggest problem of them all. And as you say, it was the way Mr. Brown did it. He did it on the Downing Street website, or on YouTube, as everybody said. It was picked up by YouTube, which everybody thought a bit undignified, and he did it without consulting Nick Clegg and David Cameron and other party leaders, the minor party leaders, or his own backbenchers. And of course, it's strictly speaking, it's a matter for the Commons, not for the government. It's about MPs and their own arrangements. Of course, the government has an interest in it. Last but not least, he tried to bigfoot Sir Christopher Kelly, the chairman of the Committee on Standards in Public Life, who had already been asked to sort this one out, and was rather surprised to read in the newspapers that it was all going to be overtaken by this Brown initiative. So a dog's dinner.
Is the departure of Damien McBride, does that have any bearing on the way that Gordon Brown's presentation has gone a bit wrong over this?
Well, it's a reasonable question to ask. I don't know whether Damien McBride would have said, "Oh, Mr. Daft Prime Minister, you look a complete wally on YouTube. We can't possibly put that anywhere near the Downing Street website. In fact, you know, the copy should be burned and then cast off the side of a boat in the North Sea." We don't know what he said or would have said if he wasn't there to say it. But, you know, it'd be nice to think he earned his money keeping Mr. Brown out of mischief, not just sending naughty emails.
Meanwhile, Mike, I mean, as you say, there's a potential disaster coming in July if they don't sort this out. Do you think they will, though?
The Commons Committee on Standards and Privileges, they're the people who police MPs' transgressions. They have an investigation by the, what's called the Parliamentary Commissioner. He reports to the committee and they say, either we agree with you or the punishment or the findings are too soft or they're too hard or they're wrong. They generally agree with each other. Anyway, that committee, which has got some Labour heavies on it, people like Chris Mullin, ex-minister, knows his own mind, this committee voted unanimously to ask Mr. Brown to postpone tomorrow's vote and say, look, let's sort it out gently and with some dignity. Let Kelly complete his findings and we should accept them. And, you know, we've learned our lesson and that's the best way to proceed. Mr. Brown doesn't want to do that.
Michael White. My name's John Dennis. This is Guardian Daily. Still to come, Kevin MacDonald, director of the journalism film State of Play.
You can't make a film in Washington about politics and journalism without referencing All the President's Men. And it's the kind of, it's hovering there above you, or it's, you know, the elephant in the room all the time.
But first, tomorrow it'll be exactly 1 year since Boris Johnson was elected Mayor of London. He beat Labour's Ken Livingstone, promising to tackle crime, improve public transport, and get value for money for taxpayers.
I can't believe that I'm the only person in this room who, you know, sometimes in the last 9 months thought that I would never actually ascend that brilliant Richard Rogers, or is it Norman Foster? Norman Foster, sorry, spiral staircase into the upper carapace of this wonderful onion.
The Metropolitan Police Authority this morning accepted with sadness the resignation of Assistant Commissioner Bob Quick. And on behalf of the authority, I want to pay tribute to all the work he's done over many years, especially in the field of counter-terrorism.
The message is, I want to make sure that the City of London, which contributes 9% of UK GDP, 13% of value added, is not accidentally incapacitated by any kind of punitive raid on, you know, the very many bad bankers there have obviously been, the very many greedy bankers there have obviously been. We'd be cutting off our nose to spite our face, you know, we'd be throwing the baby out with the bathwater, or supply any other metaphor you want.
I say this respectfully to our Chinese hosts who have excelled so magnificently at ping pong. Ping pong was invented on the dining tables of England, ladies and gentlemen, in the 19th century. It was, and it was called whiff-whack. And there, I think, you have the essential difference between us and the rest of the world. Other nations, the French, looked at a dining table and saw an opportunity to have dinner. We looked at the dining table and saw an opportunity to play whiff-whack.
In an interview with The Guardian today, Boris Johnson says he's very likely to run for mayor again. And despite rumours that he has ambitions to become Prime Minister, he says being mayor will almost certainly be the last big job he'll do in British politics. He gives himself just 6.5 out of 10 for his mayoral performance to date. Dave Hill's been following the mayor's progress on his blog on The Guardian's website. How does he rate Johnson's performance?
I think my feeling is that, and I say this in an entirely apolitical way, that thus far he hasn't been too bad for a Tory. And the signs are that he will continue that way, although I think it's going to get more difficult for him. It's a 4-year term as London mayor. We've had 1 year. He's getting into that difficult midterm territory now, when some of his bigger policies, the areas where he can really make a difference, they're beginning to come into play now. And we're going to start seeing what their true effects have been.
And these are?
Well, transport is the area where the London mayor has the greatest powers. I felt that Boris's policies were significantly weaker than Ken Livingstone's. He's taken an approach of basically being less ambitious. He's put fares up, which isn't particularly popular with Londoners. The state of the economy has made it difficult and less room for him to manoeuvre. But I think his broader vision of transport is a bit disappointing. His predecessor basically squeezed the motorist and made more room for buses, which I thought was a good set of priorities. Boris's plan, if we put it in the simplest and most favourable way, is really to try and make all the different elements of transport in London, all that complicated interconnecting networks, work together more smoothly. That's his sort of aspiration. I'm not sure that this is going to work out particularly well. Losing the bendy bus, some people don't like him very much. I think it swings and roundabouts with the different kinds of buses, really. They're going to be replaced by conventional double-deckers and conventional single-deckers. This is likely to actually cause more congestion rather than help things move more smoothly. The other slightly disappointing thing, I think, particularly the cyclist lobby feel this, is that although he's planning to bring in this bike hire scheme next spring, modelled roughly on the one in Paris, and perhaps that will be a great success, there has at the same time been a cut in funding for bike lanes of the type that we see in, you know, some parts of the city already. That's disappointed the cycling lobby. It disappoints me a bit too, because, you know, I don't need to hire a bike. I own one, but I'm not going out on those streets. They're too dangerous.
And talking of dangerous streets, I mean, crime and law and order was another of Boris's priorities. What difference has he made in that area?
I think it's been an extremely mixed bag, really. The most dramatic thing he's done was bring about the downfall of Sir Ian Blair. And the replacement for Sir Paul Stevenson, was the man that he wanted in the job. So he's got what he wanted there. The theory is that Sir Paul is a much more no-nonsense, efficient kind of policeman, not as interested in showboating or playing politics. That's what they say. Now, Sir Paul has only just got his feet under the desk. Police crime statistics have continued to show falls in most categories of crime. They were doing that under Blair. To what extent Boris can take credit for that, I don't know. The knife crime epidemic, if that's not the wrong word, which was going on at the time of the election campaign, that seems to have passed its peak, but it's very difficult to say why that is, you know, to what extent has Boris helped. What I would say is that I'm quite confident, in a funny way, that a conservative political administration can sometimes bring about greater efficiency and effectiveness in a conservative institution like the police than a Labour type one can, and I'm fairly hopeful that will happen. But the extraordinary thing that's happened, the thing that's sort of thrown it all a bit off course, has been the G20.
You said that Boris hasn't done too badly for a Tory. He's actually distinguished himself from David Cameron and the central policies of the Tories on several issues. And what are Boris Johnson's political ambitions?
Well, I think I think Boris has been broadly in line with David Cameron in most ways. I mean, we're all fascinated by the little deviations and the fact that he's a bit more outspoken in defence of bankers and so on. But you've sort of got licence to do that if you're the Mayor of London. And if you're Boris, you've got licence to do that as well. And, of course, with bankers, the financial sector has been important to the metropolitan economy. So it's a sort of rational thing for him to do. I think we can get a bit too excited about that. But if you're asking me, would he like to be Prime Minister one day? I'm quite sure that if the opportunity should ever present itself, he would bite your hand off, you know, because Boris has got enormous amount of self-confidence, ambition and willpower. Whether this is actually going to happen is difficult to say. I think it's far too early in the game, really, to predict what's going to happen. I suspect he very much fancies being mayor in 2012 when the Olympic Games open. You have to win another election, run for election and win it in order to do that. Dave Hill.
State of Play is the new film about a newspaper that uncovers a major political scandal in Washington. Russell Crowe plays the reporter and Helen Mirren is his editor.
I know you got shot at last night and I know I should be making you a nice cup of cocoa, but I'm just so bloody angry. I mean, the decision, I'm assuming, was that this was not news.
We were worried that we were
going to... It was my call, Ken. All right? I didn't and I don't believe her.
Oh.
She's not credible. She was just trying to sell us her sexy scrapbook photos of her friend Sonia Baker.
State of Play's director, Kevin MacDonald, whose previous films include The Last King of Scotland, told Jason Solomons how the original BBC television series, on which the movie is based, took as its inspiration the offices of The Observer.
Paul Abbott, who wrote the original series, told me that he never went to visit the offices. I think he just had some friends that maybe worked there or something. I don't think he did that much research about journalism. And that was one of the things that I thought, well, we can do this differently. We can actually set this in the kind of contemporary world of journalism, the crisis in newspapers that's going on around the world, but particularly in America.
Most of the journalists of my generation, a lot of them went into it or were inspired to do so either by someone like John Pilger, who was rather sort of tweed jackety kind of patchy corduroy arms thing, or because they saw All the President's Men.
You can't make a film in Washington about politics and journalism without referencing All the President's Men, and it's the kind of, it's hovering there above you, or it's, you know, the elephant in the room all the time. And so we felt we should directly acknowledge it. And so there are, you know, references. Russell even has a photo of Woodward and Bernstein buried somewhere in the detritus around his desk that you can see on the big screen. But one of the things that interested me was how the perception of journalism has changed from 1974, whenever All the President's Men was made around then, and today. And you know, these days, journalists are seen as kind of, you know, unreliable, ethically dubious, scraping a living on the fringes of things. And that's very much a return to the kind of, you know, the cold-blooded, cynical journalist of the front page, say, you know, 1930s, 1940s.
I wondered if you know, you would work with Russell on constructing this character, or he'd literally just come, because he'd just come to the set from his, whether it is a ranch in Australia, and just arrived.
Well, you know, he came in quite sort of late onto the film, and the thing about Russell is that he is a genius at just finding the telling detail and really understanding a profession, understanding how people work.
Did you know this before you worked with him?
Well, you could see it in his performances. I mean, you know, I had the great opportunity to be able to say, you know, Brad Pitt pulls out of my movie, and the studio said to me, "So who else do you want?" And I said, "Well, Russell Crowe. He's the finest actor, who's an A-list star as well. I want him." But there would just be little details of things that he would come up with that you would go, "Aha! Now I understand that this person exists beyond these 2 hours of celluloid." Yeah. And little things like him turning up with on the first day of shooting, he turned up with a pink breast cancer awareness armband, and I said, "Why are you wearing that?" And he said, "Well, I think my character's mother died of cancer." And suddenly I thought, well, that's, you know, that's really interesting, because that sort of explains why this character is so reluctant to engage in a long-term relationship, doesn't want to settle down with a woman, maybe he's afraid of losing her again. Mm. And suddenly you felt a whole kind of history, a whole other world, a whole other dimension of this character opening up.
Kevin MacDonald talking to Jason Solomons, and you can watch a longer version of that interview at guardian.co.uk/film. Phil Maynard and Tim Mabey produced today's podcast. My name's John Dennis. Thank you for listening.